Hi, I'm Megan, and welcome to Word Crash, the game show where questionable plots compete for your vote to win a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy. First off, let's meet our contestants. Today we're joined by songwriter nerd and author of the Wakeful Wanderer's Guide series, Jim Infantino.
Hi, Megan.
Hi, Jim. Wonderful to have you with us today. Next, we have a mother of three. She's a Coke Zero addict and author of the Daughters of India series. Please welcome Megan Elder Evans.
Thank you for having me.
For our listeners at home, there could be some confusion because now we have two Megans, but Megan Elder Evans goes by Meg, and so that's what we'll use for her today. Well, nothing left to do but get to it. Let's play some Word Crash. First, we have a game we like to call Time of Your Life. Retell an experience from your life in the genre of your choice. Meg, why don't you go first?
Okay. I will go with my firstborn's birth. And I would like to do it as a comedy because in reality, it was anything but a comedy.
Taking a hard turn from reality there. What would you like to make funny that definitely wasn't funny?
Maybe specifically the seriousness of the situation. I ended up in the OR having an emergency C-section. And so I'd really like to make fun of that.
Do we have a funny doctor? Is that how we're going to lighten it up?
Oh, I'm the one who's funny because they gave me Ativan when I had my panic attack. To kind of pull from reality, apparently I was waving my arms about in the OR and the nurses had to pin me down. I don't remember that at all. And apparently I kept asking where my arms were. So you see how this can easily become a comedy.
Absolutely. Instead of not being able to feel your arms, maybe they need to inject you with something wrong. Not exactly what they were supposed to be. There's some kind of mix-up, and they give you something, and maybe you think you're a chicken with the waving arms.
Oh, yeah. Like, where are my arms, and why do I have feathers, right? Where are these feathers coming from?
Jim, how do the doctors react to this?
I can see the doctors, knowing that you're on, you know, you're kind of high, riffing on this a bit, maybe taking a kind of a Groucho Marx approach to the situation. Well, I'm not exactly sure what she said, but I love the way she said it.
We have our main character in the OR thinking that they're a chicken, about to lay their first egg. That's the exciting part. How do we lead up to this?
There was an absent doctor. My doctor really was absent for 2 days. I was in the hospital a total of five. She was MIA for 2 days. The doctor who did my C-section, I didn't even know him.
Maybe we need a plot line about where this doctor was. Jim, where could this doctor be traveling from? That's such a problem.
Well, I'm imagining a kind of a comedic version of the opening scene from The Nick, if anybody has seen The Nick, where the doctor is emerging after a long night of debauchery in an opium den and finds a horse-covered carriage, pulls out his cell phone. He's like, I'll be right there.
I want to piggyback off of what Jim's actually, not maybe quite going as dark as you did, but yeah, maybe my doctor did get into some stuff and somehow managed to bring it with her to the hospital. Somehow ends up, instead of me getting the Ativan, I'm getting whatever she was taking.
Maybe she was dealing drugs to pay for medical school and she developed something.
The anesthesiologist has to play a large part in this comedy. Swaps the drugs.
Ah, grabs the wrong thing.
Yeah.
It probably should be labeled the wrong thing. Let's make it labeled the wrong thing and not make the anesthesiologist an idiot. It was an honest mistake. It was labeled Ativan, but instead it's this drug. Can we make it a hallucinogen? Would that be funnier?
Always.
Like a psychedelic?
That would definitely explain me thinking I'm a chicken and flapping my wings.
And now we need something heartwarming, somebody who's doing the best they can.
Well, my husband was doing the best he could at the time.
But things go absolutely wrong for your husband during all this.
Maybe I lift up and I peck him in the face at some point because I think I'm a chicken and I'm flapping my wings and nurses are holding me down and he's stroking my feathers telling me, honey, you're not a chicken. Honey, you're not a chicken. It's okay. You're having a baby. You're not laying an egg. And then I say, who are you? Get away from me. Cluck, cluck, cluck. And I lift up and I peck him in the face with my nose.
The doctor, because she has this kind of open mind to hallucinogens and surgery and childbirth, tells your husband that you're in a different space, you're in a different world, And he needs to be there with you to relate to you directly. So they give him the drug. And then both of you are talking the same language, and things get completely bizarre and out of control. And meanwhile, the baby's born, or the C-section happens, but the comedy goes on.
There's the whole screen that they put up, and I can just see the doctor going in with the scalpel and just flowers erupting from underneath it. Boom! Maybe fireworks.
Right? Feathers.
Like someone ripping open a feather pillow. Just.
What are all the soon-to-be grandparents like?
His parents are texting constantly. Is the baby born yet? Is the baby born yet? Is the baby born yet? Meanwhile, my mother is waiting outside the OR in the hallway, waiting to be told that the baby is born.
Can we have your mother try to sneak in?
Yes, she sneaks into the OR, pokes her head in, and sees me laying there flapping, 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 pecking my husband.
I'm imagining the mother-in-law not just sneaking in, but sneaking in, getting some scrubs, getting changed, lifting an ID badge from someone. Because hospitals are pretty good about keeping people out of the OR.
But she's the anesthesiologist. She has taken the actual anesthesiologist and knocked her out, and she's in a broom closet, and she's dressed up as the anesthesiologist, and that's why she chose the wrong thing, which is why all of this happened in the first place.
Because she was just trying to be helpful.
Yes.
Yes, just trying to be helpful. That's fantastic. I love it. Do we have a name?
I like Hatched.
Hatched.
Simplicity.
Hatched
is good.
Hatched. Coming to a theater near you, or Netflix original series near you?
It's already greenlit.
It's already greenlit. Jim, what time of your life have you brought to us today?
Well, something simple. I took a walk with my daughters this weekend on Saturday. We took a long walk. I told them we're going to walk 5 miles around the city. I live in Boston. So we walked over to Boston Common. We looked at gardens. And I'd like to reset this in a kind of a Station 11 setting. If you've read that novel by Emily St. John Mandel, it's in the wake of a perfect pandemic that has wiped out 99.9% of the population. So my daughter's now kind of, we get ready, just like, you know, regular dad and daughter's thing. They're like 8 and 10, and, you know, we have to pack some snacks, and we have to pack some water, and we put on some backpacks, and we get ready to go, and we stop at the elevator, and then we walk down the stairs, and then we go out into the city. And, you know, Boston is known for being one-third of its size in the summer, and, you know, when the students come back, then they fill up like millions more, so not millions, but many, many more. And it's like that, except, you know, even more. So there's about 35 people left in the entire city. And we are walking through these empty streets, talking to each other, pointing to buildings like, that one hasn't been cleared out yet. When are we going to do that one? Walking towards Boston Common, where I figured we would meet the gardener, you know, who had decided to make it his life's work, even though he's like the last gardener within 100 miles, that he's going to continue to fix up these beautiful gardens and maintain the commons, and lives in the State House, which has this big golden dome. But what happens after that? I'm not sure.
Let's start a little more with setting. What could you do in Boston anytime you wanted that would be fun if nobody else was around?
I think it would be kind of fun and maybe a little sad. You know, we would, for example, there's a merry-go-round by the Frog Pond that my girls both really love. But, you know, with nobody around, there wouldn't be any fuel to run it. So maybe they would like sit on the horses, and I would try and push the thing around and not be able to. And that would be kind of a bummer. There's a lot of opportunities here for it to be a bummer. I guess I'd rather it wasn't. We could climb up onto a duck tour, you know, a boat that drives these things, these amphibious vehicles that drive around the streets and quack at nobody. I mean, there's kind of a bittersweet element to this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not totally a feel-good movie. If we focus on the relationship between dad and their daughters and him trying to make it as fun for them as possible in this clearly post-apocalyptic world.
There could be a great scooter scene. And there are also lots of public bikes that, you know, that you can pick up and ride around. There are a lot of opportunities for scenes, but what's the plot? It just seems to be grinding down to something awful.
In movies like this, where you're building a world, you have to establish the norms, then you have to test the norms, and then you challenge the norms, and then you decide if you're at a new normal or not. Right? So we've established the norms. How should we challenge these norms? What can we bring into their world that changes it?
So I think psychologically there's something, and this is kind of serious, I guess, but there is something I was feeling in the life that I actually am living, walking around with my daughters on a Saturday, which is a beautiful Saturday. There is that feeling like the three of us are the only people in the world. So that's kind of what brought on the idea, is take that to the extreme. What challenges that is when you run into other people and you don't know if you can trust them or, all right, so this gardener seems to be doing good things. He's keeping up the horticulture around Boston, but somehow in his whatever time he's got, is he going to come after my canned food and going to threaten my kids? And suddenly when there's only a few people left, it's hard to know when you meet somebody new, whether you can actually trust them, especially if you've built a whole routine around just being alone.
What if they didn't at first know that there was a gardener? What if they didn't see him at first? And they thought, hey, this is awesome. It's this beautiful garden that hasn't been overgrown yet. Nobody's around. Let's just help ourselves. And they start picking flowers and picking fruit off of trees. And then this gardener, who's a bit of a hermit at this point and likes being just him, doesn't want anybody else around, comes out and starts screaming at them. What are you doing? That's my fruit. Those are my flowers. Do you know how hard I've worked? And now he's going to say, now you have to fix what you did. You have to replant these flowers and you have to weed these beds over here. And
this indicates to me that maybe we're moving towards a found family kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The gardener guy doesn't want people around because he's lost people and it's hurt so much that he doesn't want to reconnect with people. Right. And then you've got this father with two girls, and it's tiring being a single parent.
Yeah, yeah. And an overwhelming desire to protect them, keep them safe.
Right? Yeah.
So he doesn't know whether the gardener's a threat. The kids are thinking the gardener is somebody new and they're excited about it.
You know, if you have this garden, and we're thinking, you know, most of the population of the earth has been wiped out. We're assuming that a significant portion of farmers have been wiped out as well. And so those farms, the food supply has decreased dramatically, especially the fresh food supply. And so this gardener who is growing perhaps vegetables and fruit, maybe he's even raising a few chickens out behind the house. Mm-hmm. He has fresh food that nobody else can get now because everything that was fresh in the stores has since rotted. So they've been living off the father and his daughters have been living off of canned food, canned meat. And oh, it's just so unhealthy. And now they've met this gardener. You're right. They don't know if they can trust him or not, but they want to trust him and they want him to trust them. And they want to kind of build this little commune together.
There's got to be something where the old man has an epiphany or snaps or whatever, and he finally gets it and he's finally into this. What event could predicate him finally admitting that he likes these two girls and that his life is better for all these people that's in it with him?
Perhaps we need to include a villain who threatens their stability as a family. You know, since this guy doesn't appreciate you anyway, why don't you bring your daughters and we'll go start over without him? We don't need him.
Maybe there's other little kids to play with. I like what I'm hearing here, right? There's some kind of conflict. Are we going to break these people up or not? Are they going to stay together? Who loves who? How do we end it?
Well, I have a really dark ending, but I'm not sure I want to say it. But the end of the story, and I see it as a short story, the end of the story, the father starts coughing.
Oh.
Yeah, dark.
Oh, this is really dark. This is really dark. But that's where you want it to go, and that's where we end up.
I kill myself off.
We're not going to go into the psychological ramifications of killing yourself off in a book, but there it is. Do we have a name for this?
Boston Gardens, a feel-good short story mostly, except for the parts that are totally not feeling good.
It's time for Secret Sauce, where our authors share a technique or strategy to keep themselves creative. Jim, why don't you start us off?
I get stuck like everyone else. I have a slightly different attitude toward writer's block than what I've seen out there. I'm sure there are other writers who go this method, but I see writer's block as a message to me as an author that I am not daydreaming enough and that I am trying to write too much without taking the time to imagine enough. So when that happens to me, I stop writing and I space out. I take a walk. I stare out the window. I do anything except write words, you know, into the computer. When I come back, I make sure that when I'm daydreaming about the characters and about the world. When I come back, I know what's going to happen next, and I can easily write it. That's the only trick I've got.
And it's a fantastic trick to codify, right? This is kind of like when you're in the shower and you get an idea because you're doing anything but that thing, right, that you were trying to do. All of a sudden, you're like, I can fix that. And this is exactly the same thing. Let's purposefully expose ourselves to some activity that is not writing, but make it stimulating.
And purposeful. I think purposeful is incredibly important because what happens otherwise is you think you're not doing the work, but you are doing the work. You're doing the work by imagining rather than grinding out. When you grind out, I mean, I'm not a 15 minutes a day or an hour a day kind of a writer. I have to see it first. I have to see all of it first. I've done the other method. I've gone every morning writing pages. But what ends up happening when I pursue that method is I reach the end of my stock. I reach the end of what I know, and I end up throwing stuff out. So the work is spacing out, daydreaming, being a goofball, taking a walk, think about the character in the chapter that I'm working on and what their wants are, what they're confronted by, what their conflict is. What do they want? What do they want to see happen? And also, what's possible within the world that I've set up? And the more I dig into that and try out different ideas, you know, the faster I get back to the keyboard. I do have to remind myself when I'm writing that I can make up anything I want. And there's no rule about that. I'm completely free. It may be an absolute flop, but I am allowed to do in the writing whatever it is that I'd like to do. And often it's funny how much I forget that when I'm writing. So especially in speculative fiction and science fiction, you really have to imagine a whole ton of stuff. Nothing's given.
Meg, what do you have for us today?
Writer's block doesn't hit me too often, thankfully, but when it does, it's usually stress related. I'm so stressed out about other things that are going on in my life that I cannot think about my story. I literally get blocked and I can't move forward on it. So when that happens, I just say, okay, I'm not going to write for a while. I'm not going to write until I figure this out, until I get the inspiration, until an idea comes to me. So one of the things that I do most often, probably 9 times out of 10, is I purposefully read books in the genre that I'm writing as close to what I'm writing as possible. And I seek out movies and TV shows that are also in that same genre. And I watch and I read as much as I can until something sparks, and usually just kind of wait until the stress abates. If I'm stressed out beyond belief, I'm not going to write. I'm not going to think of anything creative. And that happened to me actually when I was pregnant with my third child. At 20 weeks, I got her diagnosis. She was diagnosed with bilateral clubfoot. And while it is a fixable condition and she has beautiful feet now, it ruined me for writing for the rest of my pregnancy. I didn't start writing again until maybe about 2 months after she was born. So that was a solid, it was months that I didn't write, which really sucked because I was in the middle of writing my trilogy at the time. So I literally didn't touch my trilogy for months while that was happening. And I just, like I said, I just read in my genre as much as I could get. And I watched as much as my genre, kind of letting my brain relax and dealing with what I was dealing with in my life, knowing that inspiration would eventually strike again.
Grab your soap and a scrubber. It's time for Squeaky Clean. Reboot a gritty book or movie to remove the grit. Meg, why don't you go first?
Okay. I think I will reboot Crimson Peak. I usually don't watch gritty movies, but I did watch this one recently, and so it's fresh in my mind.
For those at home who are not familiar with this movie, could you just sum up the plot real quick?
Yes, there is an heiress in New York who is destined to be a spinster. And there is a basically impoverished baronet who has this estate in England, and he has this mine that is in financial ruin, and he needs money. And so he meets this heiress and decides, yes, she's the one for me. Her daddy's money is the one for me. And it is a horror film. So there is lots of death and lots of ghosts. And there is this weird incestuous thing going on between the baronet and his sister, which comes out later in the film. And of course, spoiler alert, the brother and his sister both die at the end because they are both monsters who have done monstrous things. You find out throughout the course of the movie that this heiress is not the first one he has married for her money. He has married, I think, 3 or 4 other women. And after he has gotten their money, his sister has promptly killed them off.
Ah, okay. So, this is definitely gritty, right? This is definitely dark. How are we going to reboot this? Meg, tell us. Did you have a particular genre of squeaky clean happiness that you would like to apply to this story?
Of course. Now, I write historical romance, and this movie takes place in the 1800s. So this is right up my alley. We'll just turn it into a historical romance and take out all the grit. Edith is a American heiress and spinster. Sir Thomas Sharp is a baronet with no money. They fall in love, and Sir Thomas Sharp asks Edith's father if he can marry her. The father says no, because you're basically poor.
What dirty work does Lucille do to help him get money?
I immediately go, you know, of course, to drugs. But not that I'm a big drug user, but for some reason that's the plot device of choice for me right now. But there are other interesting ways to make quick money. It may be that she's into drinking celery juice, but not just any celery juice. It has to be Himalayan celery that is very hard to find. There was no end of scamming going on. You know, drinking, I mean, people were drinking radium water. There were lots of potions to make you thin and fit and pale. Everybody wanted to look pale. Maybe there's like a new scheme to fit into your dress without all of the tugging and pulling by drinking a specialized vinegar that only she sells. I mean, perhaps she's a, what were they called? The people who went traveling around hawking these potions.
Snake oil salesman.
Yes, that's right, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think to make this less gritty, Thomas has to not know that it's fake. Thomas has to believe his sister really knows these things and does these things.
And maybe there's a crumbling estate that they can barely afford or not afford to keep up at all. And they can start inviting people in to, you know, take the cure. At the time, that idea of a woman being a savant was not so unusual. So, you know, she can say it worked so well because it worked on me.
Young forever snake oil. But the catch is, it's not a one and done. You have to take it periodically in order for the, because the effects only last maybe a week. Maybe instead of Thomas Sharp marrying these other women, maybe he just romances them and they keep buying this snake oil until they figure out that this is just snake oil. This is not really making me any younger because, look, I have a new wrinkle. They're like, oh, okay, you've been lying to me. I'm going home. Goodbye.
But he really doesn't want to do that, right? He wants to marry Edith. But his sister's kind of got a hold of him. Is this where we're going with this now? It's her idea. Yes. It's her stuff. She's getting it going.
He wants to tell Edith the truth. He wants to say, I love you, but, you know, the snake oil that you're paying all this money to us for isn't real. But every time he tries to tell her, sister shows up conveniently and says, oh, look, it's time for more snake oil. Or look, I've got a new flavor of snake oil. Why don't you try it out? Or she finds some reason to pull him away from her so that he cannot spill the beans and ruin them financially.
Okay, so how do we resolve this now? I think we've got a lot of story here. We've got to bring it all together and end it.
And I suggest a turn. What if the sister becomes so successful at this that she leaves the brother and frees him from having to seduce all of these new customers to just focus on his one true love? At which point, maybe there's a settlement between the sister and brother so that he does have a bit of money, maybe not enough to keep an estate, but enough to maybe live in the city and have a respectable life.
Something's got to happen with Lucille.
Maybe she meets a chemist somewhere along the way, and this chemist says, okay, I know that this is total bullcrap you're selling, but I'm a chemist, and I can help you create a real tonic that will really help women look younger for longer.
I've discovered aloe vera. Right?
And lots of vitamin E.
I think that ties everything up. And a feel-good movie does have that tie-up moment. Do we have a name for this?
I'm thinking maybe Snake Oil Peak. Or Snake Oil Love.
Jim, what would you like to reboot to make Squeaky Clean?
Well, I was really thinking of a particular movie that I found maybe the grittiest movie I've ever seen, Children of Men. So in my Squeaky Clean version of it, the world is rocked by a sudden change. It could be caused by aliens descending and changing DNA all over the planet. Women find that they can't conceive anymore. So that's like Children of Men, the movie. Men find that they can. Gradually, childbearing moves from women to men. So we follow a couple who have been trying to have a kid for the longest time and have failed. And then this kind of global event takes place. And suddenly, he gets pregnant. They need to work out their feelings about this. She actually was really kind of counting on, you know, having the child, and finding out that he's going to have it makes her angry. Other women around the world feel incredibly liberated. And a lot of men have a hard time with their traditional roles. Men find themselves opting out of pro football.
Because they're pregnant.
Want to get pregnant. And there's just no time. So it's an exploration in a sense of gender roles, but by reversing, on a global scale, reversing the roles. And following the emotional and sociological fallout.
You could flip through to a talk show where one of these men is going through some severe emotion because now they're pregnant.
There's shock, I think. Mm-hmm. Some of the men will get pregnant without meaning to. I mean, they unplanned pregnancies. So, especially because men tend to be, you know, dogs. But I think on the other side, I mean, for some women, it might be that part of their whole plan was to have a kid and to be the one who had the kid.
And then there'd be a whole other group of women who are just going to point and laugh. Right? Especially with the unplanned pregnancies. And like, now you have to worry about these things. And it's a much bigger thing for a woman to decide to have sex. It could change her whole life. And the guy is just kind of like, I could go away. No big deal.
Big companies might start, you know, appointing women executives only because they're more reliable. You know, they're not going to run off and have kids, you know, at an important juncture. Electing women pretty much exclusively because their duty is clear.
So that's all macro level. What's the micro level? What story do we tell? Meg, what kind of family would you put together that would have a challenge with this change?
I think for one, we might have the man's mother. So now the soon-to-be grandmother kind of not maybe so much laughing at him, but just when he complains about morning sickness, you know, and he complains about being tired all the time, she can say, uh-huh, yeah, well, now you feel exactly what you did to me all those years ago. You gave me morning sickness night and day. You made me sleep 18 hours a day. So you've got, you know, the mother kind of, you know, sympathizing with him, but at the same time saying, this is the reality, sweet cheeks. Get used to it.
You know? But I can't drink. This is so much worse than being hungover.
Right. And maybe, I mean, I know that you said the wife is angry. Maybe she's angry at first, but then mm-hmm. she realizes, wait a minute, I can still drink. I can still go out and party and not worry about, is this beer going to give my kid Down syndrome or fetal mm-hmm. alcohol syndrome or mm-hmm. anything else? And she doesn't have to go to all the ultrasound appointments, and she doesn't have to get the blood drawn frequently throughout her pregnancy. She doesn't have to do the awful glucose test that makes her throw up, and then she has to come back a few weeks later and do it all over again because she voided the first test by throwing up. Mm. He now has to go through all that. So she is...
Sorry.
So now she's kind of happy. She's kind of happy, like, wait a minute. Because she talks to her girlfriends who have had babies. They, that, you know, have already had mm. babies before this change. And they're telling her, oh, honey, you're not missing anything. Trust me, you're not missing anything. Be glad he's the one having the baby. Kind of gets to sit back and relax, you know, hold his hair back while he's in the toilet.
I think it might be interesting if he's one of the only men in his friend group, not only that's pregnant, but's having a hard time with it. Because we all know the story about the woman who's like, I was so happy when I was pregnant. It's like, uh-huh, yeah, that's a great story. Either you're lying or I hate you. It'd be great if he had a friend somewhere who was going through a pregnancy that's just like, I'm just so happy. This is so great. We can't go drinking. This is so much better than drinking.
I mean, a support group filled with men that are dealing with the fact that they're pregnant for the first time. And meanwhile, their wives are all at bars. If they have wives, so then, yeah, there's even more complication.
I would like to see the Lamaze class. For these men, that would be an interesting scene.
The classic breathing exercise.
Yep.
But even the instructor's not entirely sure how this is going to work. I don't know if this is going to work for you or not, but let's go ahead and do it anyway.
You know, I'm getting a Twins vibe from this.
Mm.
No, not Twins. I'm sorry. The other Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Junior. That was the name of the movie.
I think the main characters are both of them, and it's a couple's story, and they need to figure out where they're at. She starts, you know, are you okay, honey? Great. I'm going to go out with some of my friends, and, you know, I just need to blow off some steam. You just rest.
So is their relationship good?
I see this as, you know, they finally figure it out, and they work out a way to be happy. But with some kind of radically different roles. It's not even gender roles. It's just who gives birth.
So there's this nesting thing that happens with women, right? Like, mm-hmm. you got to make the space for the baby the best possible. You know, make sure that we're all prepared for things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's an overpreparedness there because, you know, this is a big thing. And you're going to think about it all the time. Right. What are we going to do when the baby gets here? We need a bassinet. I need a breast pump. I need all these like million things, right? In order to make sure that the baby's okay. What are guys going to focus on?
I'm thinking he's probably going to overprepare in the long term, you know, because, you know, in my own personal experience, I overprepared, you know, by just a few months, you know, planning for a few months after the baby's born. But I'm thinking maybe he's already bought maybe new furniture that is baby safe. You know, he's already baby-proofed the house, even though you really don't have to baby-proof the house until they start crawling. And maybe she's come home and she's like, what happened to our glass table? What happened to our glass coffee table? Oh, well, that's gone. We've got just no more glass tables. No more glass tables. We have these cute little ottomans that you can open up and store stuff in. And they're padded, so the baby won't get hurt on it. I don't think he's just going to suddenly abandon how he was prior to getting pregnant. I don't think there's going to be that big of a hormonal shift. You know, in my experience, it was all cutesy things. And my husband was very much the practical one. thinking, okay, we got to have a practical crib and a practical this and a practical that. And so I'm kind of thinking maybe he's the same way. He's thinking practical and nothing's going to be cute. And his wife's going to be like, yeah, but, you know, it's a baby. Babies are cute. We got to have cute stuff. You know, everything can't be just practical.
Right.
You know.
I see a whole scene or maybe a montage of him running around the house with a power drill and doing things, you know, changing cabinets, and then maybe, but they're going to need a bedroom. And then like they're tearing out a side of the house to put the bedroom in. Like, oh, the backyard, I built a soccer thing in the backyard so that we could play soccer with the kid. And I built a treehouse like over the top.
I put fencing throughout all of the safe fencing so that the child will only be able to run in certain directions to get to certain destinations. And there are gates that open up, but the gates are all child safe. So only we can open the gates to get from the living room to the kitchen, but the child can only go in this way or back to the bedroom. It's fixed.
So basically he builds a hamster cage.
Yeah, like livestock, just kind of treating the child. That seems very boyish to me. Like, just treat the child like livestock and keep it under control.
This is definitely squeaky clean.
Yeah. And I can imagine this completely.
We talked about the changes to the guy. What's it like for the wife? Right? I mean, I think we've established that she's going to go through this mourning process of losing that particular purpose. Some of that's going to be a little debauchery, trying to drown some of her sorrows, maybe. But then what? What realization does she have to come to?
I think she would have to realize that she is still necessary in this process. She's not the one carrying the baby. But when it comes time to give birth, this is a whole new world for these men. They don't know what to expect. They're going to need support. So perhaps that's her purpose, being the support that he needs, even though she has not gone through this herself. She comes from a whole line of women who have gone through it. And so she's kind of feeding off of that prior knowledge to help her husband through this experience. And maybe she gains her self-esteem from that. And that's her purpose, keeping him sane through this whole process, being emotionally supportive to him through this whole process. And realizing that even though she's not carrying the baby, it is still her baby.
What is she doing during her lowest point that she has to come to this realization?
I think what might trigger the lowest point would be the question, well, if he gives birth to the child, will the child see me the way a child sees a mother? Will I never have that relationship? And that, you know, I don't know, that might be like... drinking on the curbside, howling at the moon. I don't know.
So this feeling, you know, what is my place if I'm not actually the mother? Other people go through this even now. When somebody adopts a child, everyone's always, they're concerned. Is this person going to love me as a biological child would? Will I love this child as a biological child would? And the answer is most likely yes. The need for a child to be biological is, you know, something that's ingrained in us, and that's okay, but it's not required. If a child comes into your life, you're going to love that child. There's no way around it. If you're a loving person who would have loved your own biological child, you're going to love this child. They're going to depend on you, and that's going to be a relationship that happens. And if she has a friend who was adopted or something like that, or who had adopted kids and explains to her, genes is only so much. Carrying the child is only so much. What's really important is that you're there and you do the job. That's what we'd want to tell to every parent. Be there, do the job, be the parent.
And perhaps that advice from that friend who adopted or was adopted, perhaps that advice doesn't sink in until her husband goes into labor. And they're there at the hospital. And now that it's about to become real, now that advice sinks in and everything clicks into place.
I like it.
Yeah, it's the epiphany. I think that's where we start to get to the resolution. And then at the end, the child is born, you know, and it's a happily ever after. It's a happy family in a very strange world.
Before we go, it's time to give our authors a chance to talk about what's new and exciting in their lives. Meg, why don't you go first?
All right. Well, I am gearing up to release my very first trilogy. Starting in January, I'm releasing book one titled Daughter of Madras. The series name is The Daughters of India. Book one starts with Adhira and her love interest, Benedict. Is a historical romance takes place in India in 1764 when colonization was really just starting to take hold. You had the East India Company in power in certain parts of India. I like to think of it as your typical historical romance meets Pirates of the Caribbean. Adhira Yadavar will do anything to save her family, even if it means accepting help from her enemy, Benedict, who is an East India Company lieutenant.
I think you're the first historical fiction writer that we've had on the show, so congratulations.
Thank you.
And when is this coming out?
January of next year. I want to say it's January 12th. Yeah, it's already up for pre-order. So, you know, if you want to get your ebook, book two will come out next year as well, maybe a few months later.
Wow, two books. So let me get this straight. You've written all three books and you're just publishing them one after another? Wow.
Yeah, they are already written. I decided I was going to get it done before I published because I didn't want to run out of juice. I didn't want to write book one and two and then never write book three because I ran out of energy to write it. So I decided if I'm going to do a trilogy, I'm going to get it done first. Then I'll release it. I'll get them all done.
And if people want to find you on the internet, where can they go?
I am on Instagram. I am at Megan Elder Evans. There I have a link to my link tree, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Amazon, my official website. It's all there in my link tree.
Congratulations. And if you could tell everyone again the name of your book?
Daughter of Madras.
Fantastic. Daughter of Madras. Pre-order on Amazon. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you.
Jim, what is new and exciting in your life?
I have finished book one and two, and I'm working on book three. The series is called the Wakeful Wanderer's Guide series, and it takes place, say, 80, 90 years from now in a climate-changed New England. It focuses on a traveling historian named Mardo, a runaway aristocrat bookworm named Helen. There are two factions in the world. There's the interconnected and the traditionalist factions, and they live close to each other but are in constant conflict. The interconnected have upgraded themselves technologically so that they communicate wordlessly. It's as if you kind of took your iPhone and stuck it in your head. There's a big cultural shift that goes on in terms of understanding the way they think. And Mardo is looking back at how they got there. Helen has kind of left the traditionalist world feeling very rejected by her family, looking for a sense of belonging among the interconnected. So she's a bit of a rebel. A guy named Barnabas, who's sort of the head of a town called New Atlantic, which is launching an attack on the interconnected because he wants the use of their technology for growing food and position himself as a baron. The first book is about how that conflict plays out. And so the first book is called The Wakeful Wanderer's Guide to New England and Beyond. And the second book is called The Wakeful Wanderer's Guide to Disillusionment.
And you can find them at wakefulwanderer.com. If you want to find out more about the other things that I'm working on, go to jiminfantino.com.
So which pitch deserves a place in the Word Crash Hall of Infamy? Was it Snake Oil Love or The Literal Children of Men? You tell us. Tweet at Word Crash Games to vote for your favorite story of the night. If you're listening on YouTube, remember to like and subscribe and get in those comments to tell us how you would tackle our questions today. Everything we've talked about is in the links below. Thank you for listening. I'm Megan, and this has been Word Crash. Remind you to always get creative.